You may have noticed our new branding and our fabulous new website, thestageleftpodcast.com. Well, as musicians, do you ever finish your song, EP, album, really happy with what you created, but think, what now? What's next? What visuals suit the work I've created? What about the graphic design? Or even worse, you hire a photographer who you spend money on, but they don't quite land the vibe you're going for. Well, the answer is Who's Hughes, which is run by the creative genius that is Bastien Hughes, who is a brilliant musician in his own right and will take your nuanced story and create a vision around it. Such a clever process that Bastien has designed and really is the answer to your kind of what's next question. So if you head to bastienhughes.com, that's BASTIANHUES.com, or Instagram, Bastien Hughes, the first 5 people who mention Stage Left will get a free branding consultation session with him, which I cannot tell you, you know, how valuable that stuff is, really. So do go over to BastienHughes.com, because many, many times we get sucked into a world of doing take after take or endlessly tweaking mixes for our work of art we created, and then just think, well, what's next, what now? Well, BastienHughes.com is your answer, because it's a safe, trusted pair of hands for the next stage of your work of art.
It's like meeting a Beatle or something. He was one of those legendary musicians who came from a certain era and were pioneers. We were playing a load of gigs in Australia, a part of a festival. I remember walking off stage and he actually walked towards me and he had his entourage and stuff. And I just remember that kind of butterfly feeling. That's James Brown. We'd been warned by people, you don't look at Mr. James Brown, you don't talk to Mr. James Brown. I usually respect this, but I reached out to shake his hand and, like, the security, they were about to pile on me. But he was like, hey, son, how you doing? And he started talking to me and, oh, how was the gig? He was just really cool, just really down to earth. And he made a lasting impression on me. I always treasure that moment.
You can train yourself to play the guitar and practice as hard as you can. It's the stuff that goes along with being a musician, how you treat other people. I think that that's the most important quality for me. Something that I think can really help you in your career as well.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. So go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring members of Radiohead, Supergrass, Jungle, Queen, Earth, Wind & Fire, Fleetwood Mac, The 1975, Madness, Oasis, The Zootons, The Prodigy and Kraftwerk, who discuss their writing, recording and performing processes, as well as reflective interviews with musicians and producers who've worked in the studio and on stage with the Beatles, Beyoncé, Elvis and David Bowie. Today we are joined by LA's finest Leicester import Cav to discuss 4 years of writing and playing live in the Happy Mondays, an extraordinary musical partnership with Mr. Nice Howard Marks, recording in Abbey Road with Andy Rourke of the Smiths, being joined on stage by Bonehead of Oasis, his songwriting approach and supporting Guns N' Roses, Bob Dylan and James Brown live. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than LA Vampire Cav. Thanks for joining us today. Cav, how's it going?
I'm good. Cheers, Chris. Thank you.
Good stuff. So we're recording this kind of just as we are hopefully exiting the pandemic. And I believe you're in LA, is that right?
I'm not actually. I was supposed to go back to LA in January and I just decided to stay put. I'm in Surrey at the moment. So I've got a really good recording setup at home. And my partner went back out there in January and I decided to stay here and just finish the Blitz Vega album. Because I just didn't want to. So sometimes when you're writing, if you change your location, for example, it can have an effect on the songs and stuff. And I was getting a really good vibe for all the new Blitz Vega songs, recording vocals and guitars and stuff. So I just thought, what? I'll focus on recording and then head back out in March.
Blitz Vega is yourself and Andy Rourke, and you'd be recording, I think. You released something like a week after lockdown kind of kicked in, I believe, if I looked at the dates correctly.
Yeah, we released 3 tracks and then we were just about to announce our US dates and the pandemic hit. So then we cancelled everything and I was sitting in my apartment in LA and Andy was over from New York. He's based in New York and we were in the studio. He was actually the first person to give me a mask because he insisted on, you know, was wearing masks in the studio. So he gave me a mask in the studio and that was it. And I thought it was all pretty funny at the time and didn't really take it that seriously at that point. But 2 weeks later, I had to make a decision whether I wanted to be in LA or come back to the UK and just decided to jump on a plane and come back. And I'm still here thing, and then settled back over here, but left our apartment as it was. So my guitars were everywhere, amps, wardrobes with clothes and stuff. Just left very quickly. And yeah, still haven't been back since. But like I said, my partner went back over there and sorted everything out. But yeah, it was just a bit of a change. But from a recording point of view and a creative point of view, it worked out really well because I was able to set up my studio at home, learn parts of recording that I possibly probably took for, well, relied on other people for. I started to engineer a lot more, which I've not really had the brain for being an engineer. I'm a sort of 1, 2, 3 go person, plug in your guitar and I want to record instantly, capture the moment kind of thing. So I've never really had the patience to learn the technical recording side of things, but obviously the sound recording side, but not the actual sort of controlling the desk or software. But that forced me to spend 6 months just learning and getting better and quicker at running a session for myself. And then the songs started flowing. And I've always found it, the UK, for me personally, a better place to write for some reason. The weather is definitely, it just sounds weird, but it's a huge influence. When it's grey, it's raining, It gives the music a bit of an edge. And
which is interesting because some artists have deliberately gone from the UK to LA specifically to soak up the atmosphere there, to go into the studio and record a different type of album than they otherwise would have done in the UK. So in which way does it shape you? Is it more minor chords?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think when I first went over there, California really influenced my music in a different way. It opened things up. It made things brighter, but it still had an edge, I think, to it. But then I think after spending so long there, I needed to change it up again. And coming back to the UK under the circumstances, I guess, we did, and with a global pandemic and stuff going on and just adjusting, it was the perfect place to retreat and just, I don't know, just soak up the atmosphere, I guess, and lock myself away, which worked out well because I'd lock myself away every January anyway. I'd force myself to lock down wherever I was every January for 4 weeks and just write, switch my phone off, try not to have any contact with anyone or deal with anything that could influence the creative process. So I've always taken that pretty seriously, but it's always got harder and harder as technology has developed. And I found that people want to, if somebody gets in touch with you, that they instantly want a response generally. And when you're writing, then I suppose over the last few years with social media and everything as well, then it just became harder to switch off completely. So I would just take January as a month that, look, just try not to talk to anyone for
It's a great idea from a creative point of view, just to switch off. And wow, why January?
Because it's the start of the year, and I just thought people are getting back to settling back to go, getting back to work or their lives or whatever, and they're generally pretty positive and busy, and so I've got more of a chance to get away with not being bothered.
Love it. So you spend a lot of time in the UK, but also LA. For listeners, we've got listeners all over the world. They won't know of Leicester. So I believe you grew up in Leicester, or that's your kind of hometown. I wonder if you could paint a picture of what it was like growing up there and how it compares to LA, for instance, and maybe some of the challenges facing a musician growing up in that part of the world, or the opportunities.
I think personally, Leicester was a really positive place for me to grow up. I suppose because of the type of city it is, it's a very traditional sort of Midlands town, similar to a lot of northern cities, and there was a lot of factories, a lot of knitwear factories, and a lot of industry at one point that then evolved into a lot of modern apartments, and it became like a cultural city in a way because there were so many people from all over the world there as well for, you know, whatever reason. And in a way, growing up, it was just a very friendly, cool place to grow up for me musically, because I suppose the bands that I was getting into at first at school were really popular. Indie rock and roll was very popular. There was a venue called the Charlotte, which was every band would come and play there. Blur, Oasis, just endless amounts of bands on the toilet tours. And that venue would be rammed. It would be absolutely packed every Friday and Saturday night, whoever was playing really. And so, yeah, I used to go down there when I was like 16, 17. And I remember I lied about my age to the venue owner, Andy Wright. And then he made me gave me the job as resident DJ there. So I was DJing the indie night every Saturday. And I was supposed to be 18, but I was like 16 or whatever. And so that was pretty cool. And there was a lot of musicians. I found it very easy to get into a band. I was in a band from the age of 12 or 13. And we used to rehearse in a friend's garage after school and just play Nirvana songs. And then, I wanted to gig. And they thought it was too much of a big step. We weren't good enough to gig, which they were right about, the rest of the band. But I wanted it so bad. I just wanted to play. So I left and started my own band. And that was easy to do as well. There was so many rehearsal rooms. There was a place called Stay Free Music, a place called Big Wheel, which is where Kasabian would rehearse, and we would rehearse at Stay Free. Yeah, so many musicians, a really vibrant sort of scene. Not that bands would go out there and make it big or anything, but it seemed like a lot of people who played music and loved bands. And so from that point of view, it was great. But there was a combination of dance music as well. So all the clubs were packed with whichever house DJs were on tour as well. So I suppose I was lucky at that point that there was a lot of music to soak up. So, yeah.
If you could relive a six-month period between when you were born to the age of 20, what 6 months would you pick and why?
That's a good question. I would say I was in a band when I was sort of 17, I suppose, was when we were really taking it seriously for the first time and believed that we could go out there and make it as a professional band. And I would say, yeah, from 17 to 20, well, 6 months, 17 to 17 and a half was probably the time, because went from being a local band to playing gigs in London. And then before we knew it, we were playing gigs in Manchester, and we had all our favourite bands there watching us, people from members from New Order, The Smiths, Stone Roses, all the kind of Oasis. And then we started working with Gwigsy from Oasis at the time. Manny from the Stone Roses set that up, and things changed very quickly. And I learned so much at that time because I was surrounded by all these legend who'd been around for a long time, and they'd, you know, been there and done it and made it, I guess you could say that. And I remember Bonehead from Oasis gave me his amp that he recorded, I think, a lot of Definitely Maybe and Morning Glory on, and it's sitting in my living room now and still to this day. And when I watch Oasis gigs, I see it there. So it was like I was really excited about that, and people were giving us gifts and supporting us. And it went from being a local Leicester band to being a band that was playing everywhere.
And what was Gwigsy's involvement? Because he was obviously very much a quiet member of Oasis, and obviously he left and he's not really said too much since. But around that time, how did he get involved with your band? Was he actually involved in kind of any of the technical elements of it? Was he producing you or anything like that?
Yeah, he was producing us. Yeah, I think there was a guy called Phil Smith who was part of the whole Oasis.
DJ.
Yeah, Oasis crew. And Phil was working with us. And there was Colin, who was Manny's brother-in-law. He was driving us around everywhere and looking after us. And Manny was helping us a lot. So he'd put us up at his house in Manchester every time we were touring up north or even coming down from Scotland. And so Phil, we were playing a gig at the Underworld in Camden. And Phil Smith asked Noel Gallagher to come to the gig. And I think something happened where he wasn't around, but he'd also asked Gwigsy to come down, and he lived in London. So Gwigsy came down to the gig and at the time loved the band and basically said, I want to produce you. So he really helped us out, taught us a lot, would let us record at his studio in his house, taught us a lot about the business, how to behave, how to seriously say, how to take the, and we got a lot of things wrong. He really helped us out, and we didn't work with him for that long. We worked with him for about 6 to 8 months, and we recorded at Rockfield Studios, which was amazing. And it was the first time we'd recorded at a really top recording studio. Yeah, and just learned so much from people like him at that point. And that album never came out, and the band had its low points after that. Things didn't really work out for us. And then after that, started working with Sean Ryder, like putting on club nights and stuff. And Sean Ryder was DJing our club nights. And we had this band called AKA Weave at the time, it was called. And he would tour with us. And then we tried to push this band for another year after all the Gwigsy stuff, but it just didn't work out. It was a similar time to when, I guess, Kasabian were coming through as well. And it just didn't work out. So I moved to London and decided to become a club promoter at that point. And because it was the first time I'd experienced a lot of disappointments, I sort of decided that you know what, I'll be a club promoter. I never want to be in a band again thing, you know, which is ridiculous because I was like 20 something. I just basically, just barely in my 20s, basically.
So yeah. There'll be a lot of young musicians listening to this. And often we hear that there's, I mean, not the sharks out there, but that kind of old whole idea of kind of music business, how to behave, how not to behave. And actually, it's one of the questions I was going to ask. And I wonder if anything that Griggsy passed on actually still stands up 25 years later, whatever it might be. So what do you think are the pitfalls of the music industry that young musicians who are in your shoes then could fall into? And what advice did he give you specifically to navigate those?
It was work ethic more than anything. I think that's the thing that I really got from him was I realised how hard Oasis must have worked as a band. It was unbelievable. And he didn't put up with any kind of shit. You turned up on time. You worked hard. You rehearsed hard. You put everything in. And that was, I guess, that Oasis sort of attitude. And sort of I realised that, yeah, the partying side of things, the rock and roll side of things weren't as important. Whereas I think, for some reason, because we were so young, we grew up thinking that was just as important as the music, you know, or yeah. Not as important as the music. Sorry, I wouldn't say that because I've always been a bit of a music geek. I locked myself away playing guitar rather than going out kind of thing when I was a kid. But yeah, suddenly we were thrown into this world where partying was such a big part of it that we just had fun and too much fun at times. And I think that then began to affect the work ethic side of things of being as good as you possibly can. And I think they're the pitfalls. You can fall in to just thinking that, not that you've made it, but I suppose when you're young, getting into it, you think that you're untouchable, things can last forever. And once something good happens, that's it. It's all uphill from then on. But that only happens to very few bands and artists where they just ride this kind of wave where everything goes. And there was a lot of challenges that we weren't ready for, you know, even with people we were hanging out with, people who wanted to hang out with us, people who were jealous in our hometown. Even I remember having my nose broken in a club because people were annoyed that you're from Leicester. I've still got a bent nose to this day because of it, as I always remember. Wow. It so that was something. I just remember being attacked just because people were annoyed at the fact that you're going out there and things are happening and you're hanging out with people from certain bands and stuff like that. So, yeah, I suppose just I would, if you love music, then focus on the music. Just be as good as you can. Make music and stuff. And yeah, rock and roll is important, but that'll come with it. It doesn't, but that won't shape your career in any way. So.
Sean, I was looking at the internet, and the reason, as I understand it, for the Mondays reunion and for you getting back on the scene since becoming a father, is down to this one guy, Cav. Is that right?
Yeah. The thing about Cav is, when I first met him, right, it wasn't money. You know what I mean? Which, you know, a lot of young lads that get into this business, it's like, you know, straight away, you know, within 6 months, they expect to be making, you know, £1,000 a day.
He was the guy that convinced you that to get the Mondays together at Get Loaded in the Park, yeah?
Well, you know, we'd been working together really well and, you know, things was going good for Cav, you know what I mean? And, like I say, I like the way he works and everything. So, yeah, he twisted your arm,
right?
You know, and you didn't have to twist,
right?
You know, too much.
It's really interesting, Griggsy's kind of ripple effects on you, because later on, Sean Ryder said in an interview that he really specifically liked the way that you work, or working at the time. What was that way that you were working that kind of spoke to Sean? And the result of that is that he entrusted you to basically reform Happy Mondays and recruit new members. And from then, loads of great gigs have happened. So thank you for organising that. But what was the specific thing that he saw in you about the way you worked?
I suppose I was relentless, but just that's all I did. I lived for, you know, being in a band, making music, putting on nights. I would jump out of bed at 6:30, 7 in the morning, full of beans, ready to go, write down ideas of like club lineup. So with the club night, that was the same sort of, I suppose I gave it the same input that I would be as being in a band, coming up with lineups and ideas to fill out a venue, and then going out there and flyering every tube station and just constantly talking to people and pushing it, putting everything, doing everything you can possibly do to make sure that you've got a good chance for something to work. So then that club night within a couple of nights became like, it was huge. And then 6 months later, we had the festival. That wasn't, I wouldn't say we were lucky. It was because we put so much into it. And that was the same thing with the band stuff. When Sean had seen that, he toured with us for a couple of years. So at this point, so he became a resident at the club night and was a big part of it, and was a huge attraction for other people like Peter Hook and Tiny Wilson and all these, you know, legendary music people to come and play the night. And again, it was just because we just, that's all we did from morning to night.
But is that sustainable? Because the interesting thing going back to Greeksy is that you talked about that hard work and kind of that relentlessness, and he had a stress-related illness. I mean, we had to take a few months off during his time with Oasis, which is, for those who, many people have seen the Wonderwall video, and he's not actually in it. There's another bassist playing in that video because he had to take some time out. And so it's just interesting, whilst Sean saw that in you and saw that's a really good kind of thing to have in your the age you were then, like, is that feasible as a long-term thing without getting to a burnout phase?
I don't know. I think everyone's different. Yeah, I've definitely experienced burnouts, but I would say it's when the world stopped a couple of years ago. I found that really difficult because I think I had my foot on the gas ever since I picked up a guitar. And the first time I stopped was 2 years ago. And then gradually that it was good in some ways, but also it took its toll because I'd never sat down and actually thought about anything else apart from making music, being involved with music, what we're doing next, or just, and I realized I probably needed a break to take a step back and think about where I'd been for the last 20 years. I think that was, yeah, it was like 20 years of full on intense moments. And then, so I think, I think it was a good thing. I think, yeah, some people burn out. It's really intense being on tour, being in bands. It a lot depends on the people you're with as well, and who you spend, people you're spending your time with. And then that's where I think the partying side of it, as you get older and you have experience, you realize how that affects people mentally. And then I suppose we're a lot more aware of how, mental illness, how people get affected by things and how they might not be feeling right, but they're not talking about it and stuff. And I think a lot of that happens on the road. I think being in bands, it was a very macho thing being in a band at one point. And I'm not glorifying that way of behaving, but it was, especially from the UK. I think American bands were a lot more, not all of them, but at the time when UK bands, you had this lad culture that went with being in a rock and roll band. And so there was wasn't any room for anyone to have a moment, I think.
And I think a lot of those rock and roll kind of behaviours, also coping mechanisms for dealing with the difficulties of what people are experiencing then, I think that's sometimes overlooked. Do you think that album you recorded with Greeksy would ever be released? That it was a lost album or something? Because I think there's quite a lot of people who'd like to hear that.
I doubt it, because I don't even know where the masters are, to be honest. I have no idea. Probably in one of the band's attics or something, or it's probably on a tape somewhere, on a DAT tape or something. I don't know. I have no idea. I haven't listened to it since we recorded it, so.
It's a shame. I'd like to hear it. Hopefully one day it'll be unearthed somehow. Obviously you reformed the Happy Mondays, or helped in that process. You were with them, I think, for about 4 years. What were the kind of highlights of that time, and maybe some of the lowlights as well?
I suppose when it first happened, there were so many highlights. It was so funny. It was just, we were laughing constantly. It was just an amazing ride. It was just hilarious. But we never thought we were going to do anything apart from one gig. So we were only doing one gig. That was the idea. And then we did the Get Loaded gig at Clapham Common, which was a club night that sort of blew up. And then we did that. And then we got a gig offered in Barcelona. And Sean's, let's do this gig. Okay, so we did another gig. And then a few months later, I think we're playing like Brixton Academy. And then it just kept going and going. And we ended up playing all over the world. The highlights were traveling and playing these huge gigs and playing these songs that I'd listened to as a kid or heard in indie clubs and stuff. And I know Sean didn't always like, at the time, I don't know how he is about it now, playing songs like Step On. But when that piano part kicked in, on stage, and you're playing something like, there's no footage of this year, of we played Fuji Rock 2 years in a row. So we played in 2006 and 2007. The 2007 gigs, I think you can, it's on YouTube and stuff, but the 2006 gig just got deleted for whatever reason. And I remember the Japanese promoters put us on at midnight because it was like a joke in Japan, Happy Monday. Midnight on the Sunday.
Okay,
so yeah, nice. Monday morning. So we went on, I think, after the White Stripes, pretty mad. So then, yeah, I just remember getting on stage, and you could just see people as far as the eye could see. And I don't know how many people there were, but there was a lot of people. And I just remember that gig just unbelievable. That was a moment where you, when you're a kid and you dream of playing guitar in a rock and roll band or whatever, that was that moment. That was that moment where I thought that felt like close to that dream, or was that dream. So yeah, that was incredible. And when that song kicked in, and you hear the roar, you know, of the Japanese fans and stuff, it was unbelievable. I'm like, wow, this is, yeah.
You'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who doesn't love Biz. And for those who aren't in the UK, he's currently on like a quite an amusing, it's quite amusing seeing him trying to dance on ice, basically. He's doing ice skating. And it's like absolutely gold TV, if you do get a chance to watch even just his bit each week. But I was explaining to my partner, who's like Lithuania, I was explaining the Happy Mondays and explaining Bez. And I said, like, his contribution is literally standing on stage, like dancing. Like, what else does he bring to the band that people might not actually realize? It could, whether it's in the studio or if it's just literally what the energy he brings, or keeping people together, keeping people laughing, for instance, is a good, maybe something. But what does he bring to the Happy Mondays that isn't just him?
Every time Bez, or every time we saw him at the time, and I worked with him for a few years through doing DJ gigs and playing gigs with my old bands before playing with the Mondays, and I actually met Bez before I met Sean. And every time you were in his company, he just made you smile. It was always funny. It was always a joke, and just his vibe. And I think when you're playing as a band, the vibe is so important, how you feel. If you go into something and you're just not feeling right, it affects the music. It affects the way you groove, or you just, I'm not one of these people who enjoys playing. I love punk, but I don't enjoy playing pissed off, too pissed off. I'm not great when I like to be in the moment, enjoying it, loving it, not with a big smile on my face or anything, but just, I need to be feeling it. And there's no way you couldn't get on stage and not feel it if he was like a conductor in a way. That's, yeah. And sometimes when you were nervous playing a huge gig, because you do, you know, some people do get nervous, and I do get nervous, and he would just calm you down, kind of thing. He'd just make you feel completely comfortable.
How? By just by being
just
himself?
Being there,
or anything
just talking to you, what he talked to you about. And yeah, it was always really positive for me. It was my experience with Bez was just always a smile. He always put a smile on my face.
And how do Bez or Sean differ from what we see? Because they seem so sort of the earth and on face value. Are they different to what the kind of public see in any way?
Not really. I think what is what you get, kind of thing, with those guys. Yeah. From anything I've seen recently, they just seem the same as they always were. But you know,
I think that's their appeal, isn't it, to a lot? They seem very approachable, just very down to earth and very real. You talked about nervousness around gigs there, which is interesting. And what's your kind of pre-gig rituals, if you have any? Or if you have got a particularly high profile gig, I'm going to take that midnight gig in Japan, like that's a long time waiting around that could easily go down the route of like booze and whatever it might be. Which then can impact your performance, of course. What would you pass on as advice for how to pass on that, deal with that restlessness during the day that doesn't just go down the route of, okay, let's have pint after pint?
I would say it's difficult because for me, I can't sit still. I'm marching around, I'm walking around, I'm going to the toilet like about 10 times before I, like in the hour leading up to going on stage, I'm just marching around. I can't sit still. But the only way I suppose I feel completely in the zone or comfortable is if I'm occupied with something. And actually recently with the Blitz Vegas stuff, we've done interviews leading up to going on stage. And that's taken care of it, because I would say do anything that sort of takes your mind off it. In a way, I started playing Football Manager a lot before gigs, stuff like that. Just being in the moment and focusing on something else. Obviously, in the sort of earlier days, I had the party inside of just drinking. So you drink, and that worked for a while, and then it stopped working. Yeah, I suppose the last few years, just constantly thinking about just other things, talking to people. And the LA gig we did recently, we had so many people coming to see us and friends. And I just remember being in the bar and talking to people. And then I didn't think about it. And then somebody came over and said, guys, you're going on stage. And that was it. And that was great. It was really surrounding yourself with people who make you feel comfortable, or there's certain friends you'll have that just relax you or make you laugh. And I think that's how I've coped with being nervous. I used to just like to shut myself away. I sit in my hotel room, just not talk to anyone. And that actually made me more nervous. So, yeah.
Distraction. We need to get the distraction to, yeah, basically. So you've, you know, played on festival bills, the same bill as like Guns N' Roses, Bob Dylan, James Brown. You just mentioned the White Stripes there. What are some of the kind of most kind of surreal moments you've experienced playing those types of?
James Brown was a surreal moment because we were walking off stage and we'd seen James Brown, like on, we were playing a load of gigs in Australia, part of a festival called, forget the name, but it was the year he passed away. It was February 2006, and so Sean were over in Australia and we were DJing as part of this festival lineup, and James Brown was on the flights with us. He would just be walking around and stuff, and he was really, for me it was like that moment where it's like meeting a Beatle or something. He was one of those legendary musicians who came from a certain era. And they were pioneers. These people were real legends. And yeah, I just remember that kind of butterfly feeling. That's James Brown. I've got to talk to him. But we'd been warned, and I usually respect this, but we'd been warned by people. I think one of his people, like, you don't look at Mr. James Brown, you don't talk to Mr. James Brown, that kind of stuff. One of these guys, I don't know if it was his people or it was like a security guy or whatever. Can't really remember, but I remember walking off stage and he actually walked towards me and he had his entourage and stuff. And I just thought, oh, so I reached out to shake his hand and like the security, they're about to pile on me. And like, no, he was like, hey, son, how you doing? Blah, blah, blah. And he started talking to me and, oh, how was it? Just, he was just really cool. And it was a surreal moment. And he involved with any of that kind of don't talk to anyone kind of stuff. He was just really down to earth. Really cool. That made a lasting impression on me. I always treasure that moment.
And someone else you've collaborated with, we talked about Grigsby earlier, but Bonehead. So I know Bonehead's joined your stage in the past and you've worked with him and you mentioned him giving you ramp, and he has listened to this podcast a number of times and has actually tweeted that he's going to come on at some point, but I've not reached out yet because I'm too afraid of rejection. But I'm sure he'll come on at some point. But it struck me with Bonehead that I reckon that there's probably a lot more to his capabilities as a guitarist than actually probably 98% of what the world has seen, because the particular role he played in Oasis, which is mainly his output he's ever done. I know he's doing stuff with Liam's band now. But yeah, I wonder if you could tell us a bit about him as a guitarist. And I'm sure I know he's more capable, like technically, than he's perhaps always given the opportunity. So just tell us a bit about working with Bonehead, how that came about, and him as a guitarist.
Two best rhythm guitar players in the world for me, Bonehead and Izzy Stradlin. And I think people get too caught up on the technical side of things, but they don't realise the role of certain musicians in a band. And I always gravitated towards those musicians for some reason. I would say my experience with Bonehead was, I remember he came to LA and we were playing a gig at the Viper Room. He walked into rehearsal and that was a surreal day as well, because Morrissey was rehearsing next door and Jane's Addiction rehearsing in the other room. And we were like in one of the rooms, and then we were rehearsing in North Hollywood at the time. And Bonehead comes in, he'd learnt three songs that he was going to play on stage with us, plugs his guitar in and just... It was just his sound, how solid it was, the beef, the power of the rhythm guitar, and it just, and the way the distortion would ring, it had that, basically exactly what you expect from that Oasis sound of Definitely Maybe, Morning Glory and all those albums in the early days. It was just there. He's just brilliant. He's amazing. And I think technically he can play, he just plays, doesn't he? He was playing a role in Oasis, and he did that role really and played that role really well. Yeah.
And how did the amp come about? How comes you got the Definitely Maybe amp?
We were around his house, I think, in his studio, and he had a studio in his basement at the time, years ago, and I think maybe a few beers were drunk at the time, and he said I could take something, and next thing I know, so I took his Marshall amp, vintage 70s Marshall amp that I've still got to this day. I have offered to give it back to him because I always feel bad that, like, maybe he didn't mean to give it to me, but it was one of those moments. But he's always nice enough to say, no, keep it. So I always mention it. I probably, you know, annoy the hell out of him because every time I see him, I'm like, oh, Bonehead, do you want your amp back? You know, he probably thinks
shut up about the amp. Yeah.
That's a great. And what other kind of music, kind of bass memorabilia do you have, or something that you've kept from a gig or something, a session that you kind of treasure? So if the house is burning down and everyone was safe, what would be something either here where you are at the moment or in LA that you would grab that's important to you?
Would be my Country Gent, my Gretsch Country Gent. I love that guitar, and it's travelled all over the world with me throughout the Monday's time and after. That would be the first thing I would grab. And then there's a Fender Jag that I played on Top of the Pops, which is hanging on my wall. I would probably grab that. That would be the second guitar I'd grab. Just
was that with Happy?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think I'd probably grab that because people are like Top of the Pops, whatever. But it's some musicians. But as a kid growing up, that was such a big deal. I remember sitting there watching it with my parents every week and being able to just get up on that stage and play. It's something that meant a lot to me. I suppose it was a time when my mum and dad actually, you know, they realised what I was doing as a job, because I was on a very mainstream sort of programme kind of thing.
So that stuff's important. That moment must be a big thing, that the parents are like, okay, I get it now.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I think this is serious. It's not just a joke. He's not going to grow out of it kind of thing, which is, I think, what most parents probably hope for when they're thinking about what their kid's going to do as a job. I'll grow out of that. And then, I don't know. Do whatever. But no, I think they realised pretty early on. Mum bought me a 50 quid Washburn rusty old guitar when I was 13. And I just played that guitar and again and again and again and again. And that was it. And yeah. So, didn't grow out of it.
What song makes you choke up when you hear it? What's one that kind of really gets to you? It could be one of your own ones, or just any song in the history of music, Western popular music, perhaps.
Yeah, it was actually Bitter Earth, and it's a song. The reason why it just emotionally absolutely destroyed me about probably a few months ago. I can't remember why I was listening to it. It's a classical version, not the jazz version, and yeah, there's lots of songs that hit you emotionally, but I can't remember why. I heard it on a TV show, this version, and it was a classical version. And so I just came and sat in my studio, cranked it up, and within a few seconds, emotionally, the tears were there, you know, kind of thing. And I don't care about admitting that. I was an emotional wreck. I don't know. I think the words just... I don't know, they just hit me. But I suppose because of all the instruments as well, and the way the song flows and builds and the strings are coming in, and it just keeps on growing and keeps on growing. And emotionally, it just pulled every string possible. And now, and the reason why I've blocked it out and I had to double check was basically I had to stop listening to it, because every time that song, if I played it in the car, I would park up kind of thing and just have a moment. And
power of music, hey? Power of music.
Power of music. So that's one recently that's just it's probably not what people expect, but yeah, it just completely destroyed me recently. Made me feel music again, how I felt it when I was a kid, when I those first bands, those moments where the hairs stand up on the back of your neck, feeling that kind of vibe. And I think sometimes when you do it as a job and you do it and you have so many ups and downs, then you may just, you forget why you loved it in the first place. I think that's important. You need to remind yourself.
Let's talk about you as a writer. What's the kind of most obscure or random place you've gone to for influence or inspiration? So if we often hear of producers who, if they're working with musicians who have got a bit of a blank slate and they're looking for inspiration, and they'll do quite quirky or unusual things. From your own perspective, where's kind of the strangest place you've been to, not geographically, but you've gone to for inspiration?
I would say it's not really a strange place, but I would say from a location point of view, and I always like to escape. So anywhere that's in the middle of nowhere where I won't have that many interactions is quite important to me. So when I was in California, I would always go out to 20 miles past Palm Springs, to the desert, camp out in the stay in the desert, basically. I'd put a little acoustic guitar in the back of my car, tiny one, a little Yamaha mini guitar, and just basically take it and just drive out there and just be on. It was kind of like you're going past sort of biker territory and all of that kind of stuff. It's pretty mad. It's the closest you feel to the wild, what the Wild West may have been like kind of thing. And you've got these...
Did you feel safe? And if so, and if, you know, depending on what the answer is to that, but was that part of it? Did you want to feel an edge, or was it a case of you wanted to escape somewhere that people couldn't get to you, or anything couldn't get to you? Or were you actually trying to connect in some way with something?
I felt safe because I was on my own. The only time I wouldn't feel safe is if I would stay somewhere, get a hotel, my partner would be with me. And if she was with me, then you feel responsible for other people, someone else. So that's the only time when I wouldn't feel necessarily as safe in certain parts. But generally, yeah, just completely, when I'm on my own, completely. Yeah, because you just, the whole point is to just get lost, and you can walk into bars and generally seem to get on with people. Luckily, I think I've had good experiences, maybe not many bar brawls in the middle of nowhere. Luckily, that was, yeah, people are always really nice. But yeah, just get in the just get out to the desert, and I suppose just get in a car over here and drive north as far as you can go, you know, it's top of Scotland, basically. Again, same thing. Just go in the car, drive, go somewhere. Don't plan it. Spontaneous. Be as spontaneous as possible. Don't think about it. Just go. And acoustic guitar in the back.
Do you ever write on bass?
Yeah, a lot. A lot of my solo stuff was written on the bass.
I thought that. So I listened to it and I was like, sounds like it's written on bass. Yeah, I think, and I thought, do I ask that question or not? But yeah, there was an intro of one of the songs. It was like a banging tune. It was like, it started with a kind of a bass riff. And I was like, oh, this sounds like it's been written on bass.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I played a lot of bass on my solo stuff. I loved it. It's like my, you know, one of my favorite instruments. I like turning the distortion up on a bass and having four strings and just driving it. I actually was a bass player before I was a guitarist. The first instrument my mum bought me was an Encore bass, a red and white one, and then a week later I exchanged it for a guitar. So yeah, I've always had a love for the bass. Yeah, look,
interesting stuff. So one thing that I always think quite interesting about people who perform on a stage is, who do you become more of in your personality when you walk on stage, or maybe who do you become less of? So if you take all facets of you as a human being, which of them come to the fore when you're on stage? Which side of your personality comes to the fore more?
You know what? The honest answer is I really don't know, because I think once that first note is played, I just black out. I need to black out to remember the lyrics, otherwise I won't remember them. I'll lose them. So if I'm completely normal, I can't remember stuff. I make mistakes. I need to completely go somewhere else. And that's not being like all.
And where is that place? Is it actually just thinking about what the next line is? Is it actually thinking about the lyric meaning of the song?
If I start thinking, it's gone.
Oh, right. Okay.
That's it. The chord's gone. The riff's gone. Anything's gone. It's gone. It's over. And then you're just embarrassed and not doing a very good job at just screw it up. So the key is for me is just, and it seems to happen all the time with all the maybe thousands of gigs maybe I've played over the years. I would say that maybe more than 70% of them I have. It's like a little blackout kind of thing. I would say I can't remember the actual emotions while I'm playing the gigs.
Interesting, but it's like an anesthesia.
Yeah, it's a weird kind of, yeah. I just don't know, but all I know is that it can be a bit weird, because sometimes you'll say something really embarrassing down a microphone. I always kind of, but that's another thing. You can be like self-conscious as well about, I enjoy a bit being a frontman, I guess, in some bands, but it wasn't something that I ever thought I would do. I was just a guitar. I wanted to be not just a guitar. I wanted to just be a guitar player, but a singer didn't turn up for rehearsal band practice with one of my bands. So I ended up singing the songs that I'd wrote and then ended up staying in that sort of role in most bands. So yeah, it's having an uneasy relationship with it, actually. So I need to black out, yeah.
And out of all the gigs you've ever played, you talk to thousands of gigs you're talking about there, what's one that you would love to go back and be in the audience for? That's not the Japan one that you mentioned earlier.
Japan one. I think Camden Coco.
Oh yeah, yeah. I know, yeah.
Yeah, played that with my solo stuff and a band. And we were supporting Kasabian, I think, 2 weeks later or a week later at Brixton Academy. And we just played, they were doing all the Olympics gigs for Hyde Park and stuff. So we just played Hyde Park that month. And,
oh, wow.
And I'd been living in the States and I'd come back. I'd moved back to the UK that year, 2012. And that gig was just, yeah, that was one of those, again, I can't remember the emotions of the actual gig, but I've watched a video of it recently that a friend who'd filmed it properly, he'd filmed the whole gig, and I was pleasant. I was just, it the crowd were just going nuts. And I think that was the thing. The energy of the audience was unbelievable. And we were obviously riding off that. And yeah. And they were singing songs that I didn't realise people knew. So that was pretty mad.
This is Gem Archer, and you're listening to the Stage Left podcast.
Fucking one.
And one amazing collaboration you had, like quite random but absolutely extraordinary collaboration, was with Howard Marks. Wow, what a character to work alongside. I remember seeing him do at the Glastonbury Festival, doing like a book reading. Like he just read, like he had a 45-minute set and he did, I don't know, two or three chapters of his book, and just he had a huge audience that were just like holding on to every word he was saying. Such a great personality. Obviously he's passed away now, which is obviously sad. What did you love about him as a character? And wonder if you could tell us about how that collaboration came about, because it's quite unusual.
Again, I was when we were doing the Get Loaded Club nights, Sean invited him down to DJ, and he was a friend of Sean Ryder's. Howard couldn't DJ at the time, but we booked him to DJ, and this is what we do. We just book anyone to DJ, and they couldn't DJ. So it was just a standard sort of thing. It's like, yeah, be all right. Get massive and get in the DJ box. Let's go, kind of thing. That was the kind of attitude of the whole thing. And I think that's why it worked. But Howard was in there, and Sean went, Howard can't DJ, can you DJ for him? So I was like, yeah, cool. And that was it. So we DJed together, and it was just one of those moments where you're in awe of Howard Marks. I mean, he's just an incredible guy, but he just made me, he was just so nice. Mr. Nice. He was so nice. He really was. He was so cool. He was just, and we just bonded over music, and then we became friends. And we hung out and we would talk on the phone and just chat about stuff and just gradually became closer and closer over the years. And then I wrote a song. I don't know how it came about. I don't know if he asked me to do it or I did it and then said, oh, I've wrote a song called Mr. Nice. Would you work on it with me? And I can't remember exactly how it happened but he loved the song and he was really excited about it. And he was just a really great bloke to be around.
When was the last time you saw?
I was told by a friend that he wasn't well and I was in the States. And I think it was my longest time that I'd been there without coming back. So it was like 2 years or 3 years or something. So I hadn't really been in touch with him for a while. And somebody said he was ill and they were doing a concert in London at the venue in Camden again? No, in Kentish Town. Forum, is it?
Forum, yeah.
Yeah, so they're doing a concert. I think lots of people were playing Super Fairy Animals and all his friends. And yeah, I didn't come back for it. Yeah, I do regret that a little because I can't actually remember the last time I think it may have been, we had dinner in Leeds, a restaurant that was near to where he lived because he lived in Leeds. I think we had dinner around, yeah, I think. Went back to his place and hung out. And yeah, but he was just such a special person. I think one of my highlights of hanging out with him was we were doing a gig and I was playing a solo gig, and it was somewhere in South London. Oh, I can't remember again. The place, the venue, well-known venue anyway. And so Howard came down, and Shane McGowan was there as well. So he brought Shane McGowan down, and probably one of the funniest nights I've ever experienced, you know, just being in a backstage room with Shane McGowan and Howard Marks together. That was pretty incredible. Yeah.
What's an underrated skill that you think every musician should have?
It's not actually a skill for me. It would be their attitude, how humble you are, how you treat other people. It's more of a, yeah, it's the stuff that goes along with being a musician. You can train yourself to play the guitar and practice as hard as you can. You can practice the drums. Yes, there's a lot that goes to, yeah, goes with how some people have a certain vibe and feeling and they can play three chords completely different to another person. And that is definitely true. And I believe that totally. But I feel some people are, I don't know, they just get lost in thinking maybe they're... When I was watching the Paul McCartney documentary, and he just seems so home to earth. And I think that's the most important quality for me. That's something that I think can really help you in your career as well. Not that that's something you should think about and say, oh, it's guy scratch your back kind of situation. But I think that's it. One of the biggest things I did, I suppose, when I was in the Mondays, one of the most important, not biggest things, was I used to thank everyone. And it was just a natural thing. I didn't realize that it would help me out later in my musical career. But I would thank the sound guys, the roadies, the lighting engineer, the promoters, just anyone and everyone, and just ask them their name, kind of thing. Like, I know it's a stupid thing, just like you would if you're going out in any situation. And I was genuinely interested. Oh, that's John. Oh, cool. Okay, you're doing the lighting. Oh, cool. And chat to people. And so when I did my solo stuff, that seemed to, there was a lot of people who helped me out. Because to be totally honest, when I went solo, I wasn't going to be packing out venues and stuff. Sometimes in some cities, I did really well, but not everywhere. And so I would get gigs and we'd be flown to certain cities and stuff and put in a 5-star hotel. It wasn't just because we were going to sell 1,000 tickets or something. It had more to do with people just, I don't know, they wanted to help you out. They were quite responsive to say, oh, will you give us a gig? Yeah, cool. And it's just appreciating people, I think.
I think that's a great answer. And we talk about advice on this podcast because I think it's worth passing on. But what's the best advice anyone has ever given you?
Advice someone's given me? Oh, that's a tricky question. Again, I think actually it's to focus on the music. And that goes back to actually people like Wigsy and people like that, that don't worry about all the other stuff. Don't worry about the sponsorship deals and all the stuff that when you're a teenager, you're like, oh, great. I want to deal with Gibson Guitars and maybe they'll give me a guitar one day, or Gretsch Guitars or whoever who do sponsor me now. That's an amazing, and I really appreciate that. But back then, it's all the silly stuff. Just get your head down, rehearse, be as good as you can be, enjoy it, do it for the right reasons, and then everything will come to you. Generally, you'll get to a certain level. If you put the work in, I think with anything, it's just work hard. That's the best advice people have given me all the way through my life with anything. I didn't want to work hard at school, so I didn't do well at school. I wasn't interested to... I did learn stuff, obviously, but I just wasn't that way inclined. I love looking out the window and dreaming about being in rock and roll bands. And it's a work ethic thing. Just if you put in, you'll get something out of it.
Blitz Vega, big tunes. I mean, the three I've heard so far, absolutely massive tunes. Let's talk your next project. So you've obviously got, you've recorded what, another kind of batch of songs that are going to be released as a whole album? Would that be right?
Yep. So actually, I finished all the vocals on the album yesterday.
Oh,
so
nice.
I feel really relieved because...
So is it just you and Andy Rourke, just the two of you?
No, me and Andy started the band and we have a great bunch of musicians there again. And that goes to what I was saying, I think at some point earlier, maybe I did say this, maybe I didn't, but it's the ego thing and the attitude and everything. And all the guys we have in the band, none of them have an ego. They're all cool. They just love playing. Craig is just an incredible drummer and a brilliant person to be around. Acer, our keyboard player, he's been a friend of mine since like 16. I've known him for years and years, but we haven't played in bands together. And again, just a salt of the earth, down to earth guy who just loves playing keyboards and loves music and goes to gigs all the time and just is that person who's just so passionate about music, basically. And we've got a guitarist called Tom. He's actually a British guy, but he's based in LA. And again, just down to earth guy. But
so what's the plan?
And Greg as well, the guitarist, who's an unbelievable guy and probably would be someone I'd say, again, it's just his values as a person are just so, it's just really refreshing to see. Good to be
so around. What's the plan with the record? So what we're going to hear and when
we've basically just brought in new management and we are now in the process of just discussing who we're going to release the album and tracks with. But we've got some really exciting stuff happening. We've got people on some songs that if you're a music fan, you'd be pretty excited about, I think. I know I am. Yeah, but I can't actually say anything about it because I'm signing things allow me to say stuff, but I'm dying to tell people. But yeah, we've got some really cool collaborations and stuff on the record. And I scrapped the vocals for the album probably about, I think, going into double figures, definitely.
Wow.
And then re-recorded everything over the last 2 weeks.
And what's different? How are you going to make sure that you don't scrap these ones? Because scrapping them kind of 10 times or whatever, that's where you need your producers to say, no, look, this is good enough. So is there a bit of a risk that you could end up just going, okay, I want to listen back to it, I need to redo it, and then you just never release anything?
Yeah, I think you can get into that, but I've never been that kind of person who was... I don't know. This is another piece of advice. Don't kid yourself. Always be honest with yourself because you can't... It'll always bother you. So if you're going to let go of a track, make sure you're happy with it. But also have people around that you trust who are honest with you. And also don't be scared to have criticism because they're all opinions at the end of the day. Music is an opinion. Yes, people can tell you to sing in tune and play guitar in a certain way. Feeling is more important than anything, I find. So even if there's mistakes on a record, the feeling from that take that you've captured is more important than getting the part completely right or how you think it should be played. And that is something that I'd advise musicians on, is just go with it, feel it. And if it feels right, then just... And I think that was the thing. So in lockdown, what happened was because there were so many positives from having my own studio and being able to run my own sessions. But I suppose the negatives were whereas I was used to going into recording studios, we're on a clock. So I need to get my vocals done very quickly and my parts. Otherwise, it's going to cost, you know, more money. So you're like, going, right, okay, I've got to get it done. Whereas having your own studio, then you're able to just take your time and record for hours. And so you can get into a pattern where you can lose that feeling and vibe. So I went through a stage where I was kidding myself that all the takes sounded good. They're in tune. I was delivering the melodies properly from a vocal point of view. And then I just, 2-3 weeks ago, I just went, you know what? I'm just going through the motion. I'm just doing it for just because I know how to do it rather than feeling it or performing those vocals. So then I just took out the vocals on most of the songs, scrapped using a decent, like a top mic. The guys at like Prism Sound, Titan guys, Prism Sound, and they gave me a Titan, and they probably won't like this, but this SM58 through it and sang all the vocals on an SM58 and captured the emotion that I wanted to capture and perform the songs like it was my last gig on earth kind of thing. Switched all the lights off and pretend, just lost myself within all the music. And yeah, over 2 weeks did it, and I feel like I can breathe. I'm happy with the music now, and that's the most important thing. I said to Andy yesterday, I met Andy for the first time in London yesterday. He's over from New York, and it was the first time I saw him since we escaped from LA in a way, and COVID happened. We were in the studio, and then we both left. He went back to New York and I came back to the UK, and that was the last time I saw him, March 2020. And obviously we've been working together online, but yeah, we were sitting down yesterday and he was like asking me why the vocals had taken so long. And I was like, I just can't kid myself, can I? I could tell everyone I'm happy with them, but if every time I close my eyes, I'm annoyed at myself for faking it, then how can I just let that go? So I just did it in 2 weeks and went for it.
I think that there's been so many great nuggets of like advice you've given throughout this. So the whole idea about it being like locking yourself away in January, the idea of driving to a desert with an acoustic guitar, or whether maybe even Scotland, as you say, performing tracks like it's the last time you'll ever perform them, I think is such a great mindset to get into when you're, you know, recording, think about Red Light Syndrome, etc., etc. Being surrounded by critical friends as well, people who can actually say this might need a tweak, or you can trust their judgment. I think you've passed on so much wisdom and advice and actually insight, and actually quite some funny stories as well. So listen, we really look forward to hearing that Blitzvega record. We look forward to hearing who's on the record. Hopefully we'll see you tour at some point soon, and just best of luck with all of it for the next year or so. And thank you for being such a great guest in the Stage Left podcast.
I appreciate it, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
This episode was mixed and edited by Bastian Hughes, Bastianhues. And that's little Eliza Day, my baby, 4-month-old. He's making a bit of noise in the background, giving a endorsement to Bastian. You should get in touch with him on Instagram, whether you need support with your mixing, your editing, your scoring, or your website design, Bastianhues. He's doing a great job.